Hello and welcome to the Motormouth podcast with Harry Benjamin and Tim Sylvie. This is the place where we meet some of the biggest names in and around motorsport, chat about their lives and everything in between. We've partnered with the Brain Tumor Charity, a cause that means a great deal to me personally. Thanks to our partnership, we've been able to create a short series of special podcasts uncovering those within the motorsport community who've been affected by these devastating diagnoses. You can hear my story, as well as the Williams Formula One team's planning director, Richard Jones, now with more to come. Also, bookings are now open for the Motormouth Charity Karting event, with places for the day now on general sale. Enter your team of four to an endurance race and compete with and against a host of motorsport celebs or pro drivers who will be drawn at random to be on your team. Gates open at 12:30 and close at 6 p.m. For all the information and to see who you could be up against, head to motormouthkartrace.com. We'll see you there, and together we can help every single person affected by a brain tumour. Without you and our sponsors, we wouldn't be able to carry on doing what we do, which is bringing you the biggest names in motorsport and delving into their lives and opinions. This season, we couldn't be happier to be teaming up with Devante Tires. What drives you? The pursuit of excellence never ends. You can now enjoy the thrill of the chase with Pro Tourer Sport from Devante Tires, featuring the latest innovations in tire technology, including intelligent water management and precision engineered interlocking tread blocks. Pro Tourer Sport has been designed from the ground up to enhance every aspect of your driving experience. Independently tested at Europe's toughest proving grounds by the most respected names in tire research, Pro Tourer Sport is at one with the driver. Ask your Devante dealer about Pro Tourer Sport today. Discover Pro Tourer Sports at devante-tires.com/Pro Tourer Sport.
Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Tim Sylvie. Now this week, we're joined by yet another big fish from the world of motorsport who hails from High Wycombe but resides in Marlow. And did you know, Harry, Benjamin, that High Wycombe is the largest town in Buckinghamshire and is the only town in the world that weighs its mayors? It does this to see if they've gained any weight at the taxpayers' expense. The weighing of the mayor ceremony has been carried out since 1678, and the town has been using the same weighing apparatus since the 19th century. At the end of the weighing, the town crier shouts either, "And no more!" But if the mayor has not gained any weight, they shout, "And some more," if he's put some weight on. Thank you, picturesofengland.com, for that little gem. What do you make of that, my friend?
They weigh the mayor, the person who is mayor.
Correct.
What?
Yeah, so they weigh the mayor to see if he's used taxpayers' money to stuff his face full of food and get fatter.
How do they know it's taxpayer money, though?
Well, you know, the mayor's paid for by the taxpayer.
Well, they don't let anything slip in Marlow, do they? God, they got a bit under
High Wycombe.
High Wycombe. Sorry, yeah. Apologies. Yeah. Apologies to anyone in Marlow. Apologies. Yeah. Well, it's always good to learn. You know what? You really are doing yourself with these random facts at the start of every single show. We've moved far away from Essex now, so it's nice. Yeah. Nice to move up the country.
Listen, shall I introduce today's guest?
Oh, I think so.
So today's guest has a hugely impressive CV, which we can track back to 2001 when he worked at McLaren Automotive before onto Daimler and Mercedes, then finding himself the managing director of Mercedes-Benz Formula E Limited and team principal of the Mercedes EQ Formula E team. Throw in some game-changing work with Nico Rosberg in Formula One and you have yourself Mr. Ian James. Welcome to the show, Ian. How are you?
I'm very well indeed, thank you. And thank you for that very, very kind introduction. I mean, it's interesting. I never knew that about High Wycombe. And it's given me an idea, because obviously the FIA have the scales at the track anyway. So I reckon we ought to start weighing team principals and having a sort of thing going forward.
What, that is a genius idea. Film it. That's a great bit of social content.
Absolutely.
As well. Knocked out of the park there. Anyway, it is great to have you on. Whereabouts are you joining us from today? It looks very, very officey, very businessy where you are.
It is officey. We're sitting in Brackley today at our headquarters in the UK, in the wonderful county of Northamptonshire. So it's good, despite the challenges of the pandemic at the moment. We're very fortunate that we can sort of at least come in here a couple of days of the week and meet with the colleagues. So all good.
Definitely. And well, let's start with sort of taking it back as far back as we can go, really. And when that first bit of motor racing, that bug bit you, do you recall it well?
Yeah, I was very lucky to sort of grow up around the sort of periphery, I suppose, of motorsports. My dad was involved at an amateur level, I suppose, way back when. And I don't know. I think it's one of those things that you either get bitten by the bug and you don't, and if you get bitten, you get bitten hard, and it's very difficult then to get away from it. And that's really shaped quite a lot of the decisions that I've taken in my life. And some of the memories that I have as well. One of the clearest ones that I've got that sticks in my mind is being at Silverstone in 1991, when Mansell won the British Grand Prix and picked Senna up on that final lap after he ran out of fuel. And it's iconic moments like that when you're growing up, stick with you. And if you're fortunate enough to then, you know, weave that into your day-to-day life, then that's something which, you should absolutely take the opportunity.
Yeah, 100%. And how lucky to be there at that race. What an iconic image. Now, you started your career out at McLaren Automotive, not a bad place to learn your trade. This was around 2001. I'd imagine back then, McLaren Automotive, or McLaren as a group, was a very different beast to what it is now. What was it like working with a company like that 20-odd years ago?
I suppose coming straight out of university and landing a job at McLaren was a dream come true. I think the only thing that probably wasn't quite so great is that I actually got the job offer a number of months before finishing my degree, which meant I kind of took my foot off the pedal a little bit and probably didn't do quite as well as I could have done, safe in the knowledge that there's a job at the end of it anyway and a contract signed. But McLaren in those days was an incredibly ambitious organisation, as it always has been, and even then the brand, the name McLaren, meant a great deal to anybody that had a fascination with motorsports. The automotive side was in its infancy. We were based, when I joined, in a business unit and Woking Business Park, so a long way from the McLaren Technology Centre that now exists. But I was there during the time when all of that was built up, and it was an incredibly exciting period in McLaren's history and the company's history. An honour to have worked with both the company and many of the individuals that were there at the time.
Did you have a planned path? You know, you got this opportunity to join McLaren, and then was it just to kind of see what happens, or did you know, I want to progress up the ranks and I want to become eventually, you know, I want to run a team?
No, there never has been and still isn't anything planned, I'm brutally honest. Apart from that, and it goes back to the beginning of the conversation, being bitten by the motorsport and I suppose the automotive bug, and anything to do with cars has always fascinated me. So it goes back to, God, after my GCSEs, I did better than expected in those. And when I came out, I remember going to a meeting with the deputy headmaster at the time, and so I was discussing the A-level choices, and he said, well, what do you want to do? And I said, I want to work with cars. So it has to be engineering. He said, okay, what A-levels have you chosen? I think it was English and French and communication studies, so the stuff that I was actually quite good at. And he said, well, you're never going to do an engineering degree with that. You need to do maths and physics. I said, well, I'm no good at those. He said, well, you've got a choice to make. And that was, I suppose, the first choice was to stick with something that really I believed in and wanted to do and worked hard at that. Beyond that, once I'd got that position at McLaren, things have just sort of snowballed from there and taken me in different directions throughout my career. But I was very lucky at the time that McLaren had the association with Mercedes-Benz, or Daimler Chrysler as it was back then. And through that link with the Mercedes-Benz SLR McLaren, that's when the first opportunity came up to join the mothership, so to speak, and took the opportunity to move across to Germany.
It's funny, we've interviewed quite a few team principals now, and they actually have a similar sort of story. You know, there was no grand plan to end up running a race team. They've sort of hopped from one good opportunity to the next. And often, I think it was Günther Steiner said to us that he would always just say yes. You know, if there was another good opportunity, he'd say yes and worry about the consequences later. And it's got him through to the point where he's effectively running a Formula One team. For the young people who are listening to this show, and we have quite a young audience, many of whom might be at college or university and might be in that position that you were, where you're thinking, well, you know, perhaps I want to go down the engineering route. What pearls of wisdom can you throw to those people? What would you give as advice to those who are thinking, I want to get into motorsport, but right now I just don't know where to turn?
Before I come on to that one, I think that just going back to your comment about the team principles and that sort of common thread that's gone through their answers, I think that's probably because we do have one thing in common, and that's we're a bit of a jack of all trades and master of none. I mean, so from my perspective, you kind of work in different facets of the industry until there's really nothing left, and you think, well, what can I do now as a team principal? I think that sounds quite cool. But in all seriousness, I think with the, you know, people who are looking to go into motorsport, obviously engineering is the most obvious thing to do, and the talent that is within motorsport from an engineering perspective is just phenomenal. So it does take, you know, somebody not only to be good at what they do and really good at what they do, but also show something a little bit different, and that's really the passion, I suppose. If I've got a couple of people in an interview who are going for a particular position, they can be equally good on from an expertise perspective and the knowledge that they've got, but the one that's going to get the position is the one that's truly passionate about it and wants to give it their all, and that really comes across in through discussion. And the other thing is that, you know, motorsport is incredibly diverse in terms of the number of different roles that are within there. So it's not just about the engineering side of things. There's a fascinating commercial element to it. There's the marketing element, there's the communications and so on and so forth. So, you know, just because you're not somebody maybe that has an aptitude for engineering and wanting to go in that direction, but you still want to work in motorsport, there's myriad other opportunities within there as well. So it's having your eyes open to that, knowing what your skill set is, and then, as I say, showing that passion at the end of the day.
And do you think, I can't remember where I was watching it. I watched an interview with Toto Wolff. It might have been on the High Performance Podcast with Jake Humphrey, I'm not sure, but he was saying a similar sort of thing. You know, almost you're a jack of all trades, and you have to have that sort of well-rounded skill set in order to run a big organization like Mercedes F1 or Mercedes EQ. Do you think you have to have in your position certain knowledge sets that are kind of a prerequisite, whether that be engineering? For example, if you're not an engineer or haven't been an engineer, is it extremely unlikely that you'll end up finding yourself running a Formula One or a Formula E team?
No, not necessarily. I think it helps to have an understanding at the end of the day. Now, you know, Toto's path has been very different from my path into the position, and I don't think he'd ever pretend to be, you know, the world's greatest engineer. But he has, through racing experience and actually racing himself, an incredibly in-depth understanding of what it takes to be a driver and what it takes actually to have a successful team and to run a successful team. So I think that what you do need is that understanding of the mechanisms that are working. At the end of the day, you're never going to be somebody that can be brilliant at everything. So I think actually in a way it's helpful to have more of a certainly in my position, a broader overview of the different things that it takes to then leave the day-to-day business up to the people who are the real experts, the true experts, regardless of whether that's on the engineering side, on the commercial side of the business or whatever it might be. And then just be there to support them. But you can only give them that support through understanding what it takes. And that's been, for me, actually fascinating over the past couple of years, is really working together with some brilliant, brilliant people, because you get fired up by their passion for what they do. And then, as I say, being there to help them, you know, push what they're trying to do to the absolute max.
That goes a long way, I think, with talking about passion in when we move on to Formula E, because I think, as well as being one of the probably, I mean, you're absolutely a championship contender, of course, but you need that passion amongst everybody, amongst the team, to keep fighting and to keep moving forwards as a team and improving performance. And Formula E has really moved at quite a pace over the last few years. You know, you look back at how it was in season one to where it's come now. It's quite incredible, the progression. What's next? Where does it go from here? Obviously, we look at the next generation, which I know Mercedes EQ hasn't stated anything publicly on yet, I think. But, you know, when you look at it, what do you see as the future for Formula E and electrification and sustainable mobility? Big question there.
Yeah. In a nutshell. You know, we've all seen Formula E go through a number of different phases already. And, you know, a few years back, we were in as recently as a couple of years back, we were still very much seeing it as a startup. And I think through Gen 1, when that was there, it was touch and go from time to time as to whether it would survive. And through the, again, the passion and the desire that, that those involved at the time had to see it through, I think they really pulled it through. And then in Gen 2, you saw this wave of interest coming through from the OEMs, from the manufacturers. And it really hit sort of a high point when we came into Gen 2 and we saw it gather the momentum. And at that point, it needed to go through a sort of a professionalization of the series itself. But the fact that the FIA has seen fit to give it the world championship status, I think, is testament to the potential that the series has got as a whole for the future. We're seeing this seismic shift in the automotive industry away from sort of combustion engine to electrification. So I think that the Formula E as a whole is incredibly relevant. And I think that that relevance will only continue to grow as well. What the series needs to do now is to find a way of stabilizing, find a way now to, through that professionalization, both on the commercial side, but also the sporting side as well, ensure that it's future-proofed. And honestly speaking, I think we're still adjusting that. I think the ingredients that it's got are absolutely spot on. How now we bring that together in the perfect recipe, I think that's where the various stakeholders that are involved are still working that out and tweaking it through Gen 2. But I think as we go into Gen 3 in a couple of years' time, then it's got a phenomenal opportunity. And I think that the direction that the FIA are taking, the technical aspects of Formula E is absolutely spot on. We're trying to balance that at the moment with the business case and financial sustainability of the whole system as well. But if they do that and do it in the right way, then I think it's got a very, very bright future indeed. And one of the things I've been so pleased to see is just how motivated each of the stakeholders are in pushing that in the right direction. So you haven't necessarily got, you're always going to have politics in motorsport, but they haven't got to a level yet where that's in any way, shape or form damaging to the series itself. I think there's a huge amount of collaboration between FIA, FEO and the teams and manufacturers that are involved. And I think if we continue to push in the right direction, then, as I say, the future's bright.
What do you think, though, of the idea? I know it's been discussed, I think, in various news outlets in the last few weeks, that Alejandro Agag and Stefano Domenicali have had conversations fleetingly about the idea of Formula E and Formula One happening on the same race weekends. I think regardless of that, it's if it were to ever happen, it would still be a long way down the line. But what were your thoughts on that? Because is there a danger that Formula E is seen as a support category, which it definitely isn't?
I think, yeah, maybe that danger's there if it's not managed in the right way. But I think we've got to be realistic. You know, Formula One's been around for 70 plus years now. It is, they say in German, the Königsklasse. You know, it's the pinnacle of motorsport. And I don't see that changing anytime soon, to be honest with you. It's got a reach which is second to none in the sporting world. So I think that will continue to be hugely successful. My personal opinion, and this is a very much a personal opinion, is that I see a great opportunity to bring the two series a little bit closer together. Now, what I don't mean by that is that Formula E should become a support race to Formula One. But, you know, we're in discussion and have been for some time about, well, what is the essence of Formula E? What's important? And we speak a lot about the city centre tracks, these street circuits that we race on. I think that is very much part of the DNA of Formula E, but that doesn't need to be the be-all and end-all. I think I can imagine a scenario or situation where we race in the future in these sort of iconic cities as we do today, be that New York or Paris or London. But then at other points, we can actually race on purpose-built circuits alongside Formula One. And the two series in that sense can be incredibly complementary. That's the reason why we as Mercedes are involved in both series as well, because we don't see them as in conflict with each other. And if anything, we see that actually being involved in both is advantageous to us. Mm-hmm. So I think there's some exciting stuff that can be discussed, and we just need to find the right recipe, if you like. And then you get into the whole technical side of things, and that goes hand in hand with that decision as well. And again, just throwing an idea out here, really, rather than anything that's been discussed in any great detail, but I can also imagine a situation whereby at the moment we're constrained on the city centre tracks because they are temporary circuits, these so-called class 3 circuits, that we can't go above, you know, 350 kilowatts or what have you, right, of power. That's obviously then a constraint on purpose-built circuits. But if we're to be the pinnacle of electric motorsport, why not push that technology envelope? So why not have a situation where maybe you can run at 600, 700 kilowatts while you're, you know, on the same weekend as Formula One, but then turn it back down again when you go on the street circuits? I think that'd be a great challenge for the engineers and would show the adaptability, if you like, of Formula E as a series.
Ian, is that the solution to the situation we saw in Valencia recently? So obviously, first race in Valencia went terrifically well for you guys. Second race, not so much. But the second race was interesting for other reasons. And obviously, we saw many of the teams and drivers running out of energy or literally going down to 0%, slowing, stopping on track and so on. The social media chatter around that was, well, what do they expect when they go on a purpose-built track? This is why the city centre tracks have such appeal. Is there a solution to that? Is it the additional kilowatts? Is it more energy? How do we solve that problem?
It's a tricky one, and it's a complex question that I suppose, because of the events of Saturday, are very much in the public eye, and there's a lot of discussion going on at the moment about how we address that. I think first and foremost, when you've got a series that's set up as it is today with the energy limitations, and I think that's done for the right reasons, you just need to therefore be careful about the circuits that you race on. You need to make sure that they're also matching with that. And I think what we saw on Saturday potentially was, you know, the energy sensitivity of the circuit, the length of the circuit as well, and a couple of other factors which play a role, which meant that we got into the situation that we did on Saturday. Do I think we need to knee-jerk into doing things differently? No, I think that we need to be careful and considered about what those next steps are. But at the same time, I also don't want, you know, to see a race again where over half the field failed to reach the finish line. I think that's not the image that we want to give. And at the end of the day, you know, the fact was the car still had energy in them. Yeah. It was almost a sort of an artificial lowering, which everybody knew about, which everybody, you know, had signed up to. So I think we've just got to be very careful about how we now react to that, and also how we communicate it in the future. I think that one of the key things is that the public and the spectators, when they're sitting there, when something like that is going on and happening, you know, there are people on the other side who are able to succinctly and in a better way than I ever could do, actually bring across the messaging of, well, why is this happening and what's going on here? And I think if we can do that, that would probably do a lot to quell some of the more critical aspects of what I read on social media, yeah, late on Saturday night.
The Twitter mobocracy was in full flow. I mean, for me, it's a funny one because, you know, on one hand, I understand that, you know, the Formula E teams and manufacturers in Formula E want to showcase electric mobility. You want to see that trickle down into road-going electric vehicles. And when cars effectively or artificially run out of energy on track, it's not a great look. But equally, and I know I'm in the minority here, so I'm probably going to get completely annihilated for this, but I watched race one. I was like, yeah, good race, you know. Watched race two, and I was like, this is amazing. Like, what drama. Like, this is why I love motorsport, because of the unpredictability of it. I wasn't thinking at that minute, oh, electric cars are rubbish because all these cars are running out of energy on track. I was just thinking, this is amazing drama. What's going to happen next? Who's going to finish? Who's not going to finish? What's going to happen after the race? I loved it. And that is an unpopular opinion. And I don't know what you think, Harry, whether you disagree, but I thought it was great. You know, more drama, the better, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, I think it was race one, wasn't it, where they all ran out of energy. But I think, it definitely, it's one of those moments where it makes you go, you sit up and you go, oh my God, what is happening? And, you know, motorsport, that's sort of, I would think, what it's also, it's an entertainment, it's a sport, entertain the fans and keep them interested. And Formula E has so many different aspects to sort of tick the boxes, I suppose.
A quick interruption to the show to remind you to check out our sponsor, Davanti Tyres. Actually, I'm not going to say anything. I'll leave it to six-time Olympic cycling champion and racing driver, Sir Chris Hoy.
Whether in my cycling or motorsport career, I'm always looking for that winning edge, the difference between ordinary and extraordinary. I'm Chris Hoy, and I choose Pro Tourer Sport, the new ultra-high-performance tyre from Davanti.
And actually, Ian, just from you talking about everything so far, I'm imagining there isn't a typical day-to-day in the life of a team principal, or is there?
No, I mean, that's one of the I suppose the awesome things about the role is that every day is generally completely different, and that sounds very cliched, but it's fact. And yeah. And also from our perspective, we not only have started up this team, but come into the series in the last couple of years, but we've started up an organisation, a new brand new business from scratch, literally from a blank sheet of paper, in order to do that. And that's been an awesome challenge for all of us that have been involved in it. And we've gone through our own startup phase where we literally didn't have computer systems and hardware and all the rest of it, and we built that from scratch, which is a phenomenal, almost sort of once in a lifetime opportunity to be able to do something like that. And now we're transitioning into a new phase of the organization while we're sort of restructuring things and then moving the team around and making it, I suppose, the structure a little bit more efficient going forward. So in that sense, every day is a little bit different just because of all the different things that are going on. The one thing that the current situation with the pandemic has meant is that there hasn't been quite as much racing as we all would have liked, and there's elements of it in terms of the way that we activate at the circuits that maybe hasn't also been able to happen as we'd like it to happen. But that will all come, that will all change in the future, I can't wait to get the rest of this season underway, and then fingers crossed we have a bit more normality in season 8.
Now let's talk drivers. Not a bad lineup you've got there. Stoffel Vandoorne came with Formula One pedigree, GP2 championship, plenty more. Nyck de Vries, 2019 F2 champion. You've got to be pleased with your lineup.
Yeah, they're not too shabby, are they? really pleased. It was Stoffel obviously has been involved since the beginning of the program, after we had, to all intents and purposes, dipped a toe in the water in season 5 with HWA. It was a no-brainer to keep him on. And it's been brilliant also to keep Gary on as part of the team in the role that he's got as a sporting advisor and technical advisor, because he's brought a huge amount of experience in there. But when we were looking for the second driver, we also said that, going back to the fact that we're a startup and a brand new team, we needed the drivers to very much be part of that development process going through. So we didn't need drivers who just were told what to do. We needed them to give some very direct and accurate feedback to the engineers. And that's where, Stoffel had the experience and has matured incredibly over the last couple of years. And Nick also from the outset, I remember the first test that we did with him when we were still looking at who it was that was going to fill that second seat, and he just had that ability to come in and sit down, and even though he knew that he was effectively in a sort of a job application process, he didn't pull any punches. He told us exactly what was right, exactly what was wrong, and it's probably, aside from the speed that he's got and the natural talent, it's part of that being part of the development, if you like, and that intelligence and maturity that he's got as well, that's part of the reason why he's a member of the team. So, yeah, very, very pleased with them both. I think they're also complementary in terms of the way that they work together. So I see good things ahead for them.
And what's their relationship like as well? Because, I mean, at the moment, it looks like they've got a great working relationship. They look like they're pals, but of course, they both want to win, and they are looking like, at the moment, they are both challenging for the title. I'm sure as the races tick by, that will bring some more challenges. Are you worried that things could get a bit tense?
No, not really at this stage, which may sound naive, but it's more a factor of just focusing on what we've got ahead of us at the moment, and making sure that we are maximizing the opportunities that we've got. I think we've, although we haven't been in formulary for that long, we've seen, you know, firsthand just how quickly things can change, and you need to maximize the opportunities that are given to you to bring home points. And I don't think that we've done that, if I'm brutally honest, for a variety of reasons in a number of situations. So for that reason, we are taking it one race at a time. And at the moment, both Nick and Stoffel, I mentioned it a second ago, are incredibly complementary. So the professionalism that they show is immense. For a one-day format, if one thing, you know, that we need to change is the fact that our engineering meetings, the briefings and the debriefs at the end are far too long and far too in-depth, but the guys sit there and they are very much part of that process where, you know, I know other drivers who just would get fed up and say, you know, I need to go off and do something else right now. So all credit to them in terms of their patience and the input they have to that. And I think for that reason, we've got a great opportunity now to start to capitalize on the momentum that we've got. But it's going to be a real slog to the end of this season. And if we are in the luxurious position, you know, towards that last race where it's the two of them fighting it out for the championship, then bring it on. I'll manage that situation when it comes to it. Yeah. So I'll be glad.
No team orders. Now let's talk about sustainability. So, you know, sustainability is a big part of Formula E. You have the likes of EVR with their race against climate change and their carbon neutrality certifications. How big a part is for your team is that of your purpose? You obviously have Vestas, who are heavily involved in that space as a key sponsor. How important is that element of things, of getting that message across around climate change?
It's massively important. I think this is where, again, we've had the advantage of really starting up from that blank sheet of paper, because we've been able to put things in place which are maybe easier to do than if you had an established organization at the front. Having said that, I think we have to remind ourselves every so often that it is such an important piece of what we stand for, because, you know, racing can be all consuming. But we're quite good at doing that. We've got a number of people within the team who are equally passionate about the environmental aspects and sustainability as a whole, because sustainability isn't just environmental. There's a load of other facets of it as well. So we're very fortunate to have people in the team who have an amount of expertise within those fields and are passionate about it as well, and keep us honest in that sense. So it's one of the things that I said at the back end of last year, you know, we had a huge push to get the FIA 3-star accreditation in place, which was difficult because we had no history, if you like. You know, we were that startup, but we managed to do that. We got all the processes in place, but we said this cannot be and will not be a box ticking exercise. This is something that we need to live and breathe. So we came up with a 12-point plan throughout the leadership team of things that we could implement over the next 12 months, over the course of season 7. And we're well underway with those as well. What's great to see, though, is whether it's Envision Virgin or NIO or Mahindra or many of the others that are involved, they also want to be benchmarking this. And I think that's a really healthy competition to have. So I think we're going to push each other to actually, as I say, not just go through a box-ticking exercise, but actually realise some things which are going to make a difference. And if we can continue to do that within the teams, with our partners, you mentioned Vestas, and we've got NEOM as well, who are like-minded in that respect, then I think it's very much moving in the right direction.
Yeah, you mentioned NEOM there. That's a project and a half. Like, what they're creating is unbelievable. If anyone hasn't heard of the project in Saudi with NEOM, I highly suggest you go and give it a Google and check it out. It's an incredible thing they're doing out there. Just on the sustainability front, I just want to pick up on something you said there. I think one thing that a lot of people often brush over is that sustainability has many facets. It's not just climate change. It could be injury prevention, or it could be diversification in the workforce, you know, more female talent, more people of certain ethnic origin. How important are those elements? If you put climate change to one side, is Formula E very conscious of those other elements of sustainability as well?
Yeah, I think Formula E as a series absolutely is, and has been from the outset. And when I speak with my colleagues up and down the pit lane, I think that there's a recognition that sustainability, as you say, goes far beyond the environmental aspects, and diversity and inclusion comes in, and so on and so forth. But again, we just got to be very careful that we don't fall into the trap of using the buzzwords, because they're fashionable at the moment. We've actually got to start the sort of the implementation of change, if you like. And that was one of the things that I was immensely proud of what Mercedes-Benz Motorsport did as a whole last year, with the end racism campaign and the messaging, and really spearheaded by Lewis and the work that he did, but we were able to pick up on that as well and make sure that we could drive that forward. And I think we've got to use that momentum now to implement change, and it's something that we actively discuss here, and make sure that we're getting the right measures in place, and we welcome also criticism on that. I think it's something that motorsport as a whole maybe hasn't had at the forefront of or in focus for a while, but now things are changing, and those that react and adapt to it will be the ones that prevail at the end of the day.
You mentioned right at the start as well that you're in Brackley right now. I'm assuming both the FE and the F1 outfits are sort of based out of there. Is there much crossover? Are you able to sort of share learnings, and does that help you, or is it very much two separate operations?
No, we're very much integrated. I mean, there's certain aspects which, aside from the engineering, but the marketing, commercial, and so on and so forth, where without the support of F1, we wouldn't have been able to hit the ground running in the way that we did. And we've been welcomed very much as part of the family, which is fantastic to see. And it's for that reason that we're going through a sort of a bit of a transition at the moment, to consolidate our activities here in the UK, between Brackley and Brixworth. Because I think that we can leverage those synergies even more than we've done to date, for sure. But there's mutual benefit to it. I think it goes in both directions. And even on the engineering side and the technologies, after our first season in Formula E, season six, we started to see some of the ideas that had been sort of progressed on the FE side start to transition across onto the F1 side. Because actually, when you take the combustion engine out of the game and the focus is fully on the electric motor and the paraphernalia that goes along with that, you actually realise where some of those inefficiencies are, where you can actually improve things, because you're not hiding those gaps, I suppose, with the combustion engine. So as we've gone on that journey, as we've made those steps forward, as I say, some of that learning's gone back into F1. And I think if we keep that dialogue open between both sides, and I'm confident that we'll do that, then I think there'll be some good mutual benefit.
It's so fascinating chatting to you. I think we could do it all day, but I am conscious of time. So I'm going to fast forward to our final three, Tim, if that's all right with you.
Yes.
Which we ask to all of our guests, our final three questions, exactly the same questions. We just like to hear the variety of answers given. So Ian, Tim's going to do the first one, I think. Let's do that.
Okie dokie. All right. Ian, what has got you excited at this very moment?
I'm going to be really cliched on this one, and say the future. I think that, but if I take a look at where we're at now and a snapshot of where we're at from the sort of the small world that we revolve in with Formula E, which is tiny in the grand scheme of things, I see a phenomenal future there, and it's super exciting. I said before about the fact that we've gone through that startup phase and then now the professionalization phase. And we've just got this amazing opportunity with those incredible ingredients to find the right recipe. And to be part of that is incredibly exciting. And then on more of a macro level, and I listened to your interview with Paul De Resta today, and it was fascinating to hear his switch away from racing for a second and talking about the kids and the passion for the family. And without getting too teary-eyed on it, I think actually if we can learn from the last 18 months that we've all been through and actually take some positive action for change going forward, then for my kids, for the new generation, then we've got a great opportunity and we need to grab hold of that. And that makes me incredibly excited as well. At the same time, more fool us if we don't take that opportunity.
No, good stuff. You've got two, haven't you? You're father of two, have I imagined?
Yeah, that? Cameron and Chloe. So, 12 and 10, so a handful.
12 and 10. No, you're, at least you're through. Well, are you through the worst of it or entering the worst of it? It's a difficult one, isn't it?
I've got a horrible feeling I'm about to enter the worst of this. Wait and see.
Harry, over to you for number two.
You'll need all the luck in the world with that, I'm sure. If not doing, though, what you're doing now, which is obviously being a team principal and having done the jobs you've done to get there, what would you be doing if none of that had ever happened?
Skiing.
Oh.
So often skiing.
Without a shadow of a doubt. Now, I think it would be a challenge to actually earn any a living from it, if I'm brutally honest. But no, my passion away from here and motorsport and the business is without a doubt skiing. And I haven't been on the slope since last February because of the current situation, which is killing me. But no, for me, standing at the top of the mountain with some fresh deep powder and the sun shining down is that there's nothing that even comes close. So
I'm desperate to go back skiing. I think I haven't skied since around then as well. Desperate, and I've been doing it since I was four, so I reckon I could have made it as a professional athlete if things had turned out differently.
Harry's 6'5". I always joke with him that he is a ski. You could just strap Harry to your feet and just fly down a mountain. He's just he's perfect.
that I have to see. We'll leave that for another day.
Yeah.
There's a video in there somewhere. I don't get the skiing thing, by the way. I must be missing a trick. I just do not understand it. And I get the après, but I just don't. Doesn't do it for me. I don't know. Mind you, I have to confess, you know, first few seasons of Formula E didn't do it for me, and now I'm like suddenly a super fan. It's ridiculous. Final question for you before we let you get on with your day. Ian, what are you scared of?
I get really deep and philosophical on this one, I think. I'm going to change the word, if I may, from scared to what do I fear? And the honest answer is pretty much everything. And that doesn't mean that I'm sort of quaking my boots every minute of the day. But I don't know why, but rightly or wrongly, I've learned that if I get too comfortable and I'm in a situation where everything's going brilliantly well, those are usually the times when something's going to completely have you over. So I live under this constant sort of base level of paranoia, if you like, and I'm not sure that's for everybody, but it works for me. And genuinely that stretches everything from the times when I'm sitting watching Nick and Stoffel and there's a million things going through my mind as to what could happen, through to sort of everyday life back at home with the family. So for me that works, and that's that base level of fear and genuinely being afraid of everything kind of works.
I totally am on board with that one. The skiing thing I don't get. That point I certainly do. And I think in that way we're cut from the same cloth, because I have that constant paranoia. But I see it as a superpower, because it means you have attention to detail and you double check and check again. And you know, it rules out error. It takes away error because you're so worried about making an error that you don't make any. You know, I find it quite liberating in a way, but I'm exactly the same, constantly panicking, worrying about
it. Watch me in Monaco in the coming weekend after what happened to poor Stoffel in Valencia on race one and the tyre error. Don't be surprised if you see me with a clipboard sort of randomly checking tyres.
Checking every single number.
Exactly.
Oh, it's good stuff. Well, listen, Ian, it's been amazing talking to you. We could talk to you for hours. There's so many interesting facets of your job that people will find absolutely riveting. So thanks so much for joining us. Best of luck for the rest of the season. We hope, obviously, we say this to none of our other team principals, of course. We hope you see you on the top step of the podium, of course, and winning the championship, the world championship, and all of that good stuff. So, Ian James, thanks so much for joining us on the show, and we'll catch up with you in a paddock soon.
Thanks, guys. Hugely enjoyed it.
Before you go, one final reminder to check out our sponsor, Davanti Tyres. What drives you? The pursuit of excellence never ends. Enjoy the thrill of the chase with Pro Tourer Sport from Davanti Tyres. Pro Tourer Sport is at one with the driver. Ask your Davanti dealer about Pro Tourer Sport today. Discover Pro Tourer Sport at davanti-tyres.com/Pro Tourer Sport. Thank you so much for listening to the Motormouth podcast. Do make sure you give us a follow on our socials, Twitter at Motormouth_, Instagram at Motormouth_official, and Facebook, just search Motormouth. You can also download the Motormouth app where you can get exclusive video content from MMTV, create your own social profile to interact with other fans, and check up on all the latest happenings with whatever motorsport takes your fancy. We're also proud to be supporting the Brain Tumor Charity too, so make sure you check the links in the podcast description to find out how you can help cure brain tumors quicker. Don't forget to like, subscribe, and review. And until next time, you've been listening to the Motormouth podcast.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.